From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Coming up, we talk about term limits in Florida. A citizen-led initiative in the 90s set in place a hard cap for how long state lawmakers can be in office. The measure was aimed at keeping our legislators honest, but a new book from the University Press of Florida explores many of the unintended consequences resulting from term limits. And there's an exhibition coming to Southwest Florida documenting the experiences of U.S. Army medical units charged with the rehabilitation of Nazi victims liberated from concentration camps in World War II. First, this news.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. Tuesday marked the 70th anniversary of the liberation of survivors from the Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland, making this week a time for many to reflect on the lessons learned from the Holocaust and the experiences and atrocities suffered by survivors of the Nazi regime and the approximately 6 million Jews and millions of others who lost their lives in Nazi Germany and other German-occupied territories. And next week marks the opening and world premiere of a new exhibition coming to the Holocaust Museum and Education Center of Southwest Florida. The exhibit is titled Dearest Pauline, A World War II Healer Writes Home. It's based on more than 300 letters and other artifacts sent by the then 32-year-old Dr. Price Duff back home to his wife in Tennessee. The letters document Dr. Duff's work and compelling experiences with the U.S. Army's Medical Civil Affairs Division, whose members were charged with the rehabilitation of victims of the Third Reich and survivors liberated from concentration camps. The exhibit opens February 1st and runs through May 3rd to coincide with the liberation of survivors from the camps that Dr. Duff served in. Joining me now is Paula Iacampo. She's a Southwest Florida resident and granddaughter of Dr. Duff. Paula, thanks so much for joining us today and for your efforts in getting your grandfather's story out there.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me here. And he's got a fascinating story to tell. And it's a story that hasn't really been told before publicly. We're all pretty much familiar with the movie Monuments Men. And the artists that were in that particular movie featured were also a part of his unit, where we normally think of, you know, the rehabilitation of the people as being, you know, mostly a medical
effort, basically.
But
the mission was much broader than that.
Right. But there were a lot of other people involved in this unit. They were engineers, civil engineers, pharmacists, lawyers. They were all charged with setting up the government of the occupation.
Right, right. I also just want to take a minute to note that Amy Snyder is with us as well by phone. She's the executive director of the Holocaust Museum and Education Center of Southwest Florida. And Amy, welcome back to the program as well.
Thanks so much, John. We really appreciate you highlighting this exhibition.
And before we get into more details, Paula, can you tell us about, you know, what span of time this covered, what years your grandfather was in Europe?
Yes, it was 1943 to 1945. And in 43, he was sent to Yale University for a specific school that prepared these civil affairs officers. And then he transferred in February to England. From England, he went to France. France, he went to Belgium, Luxembourg, and then on to Germany. And then once Germany had surrendered, he went to Austria and set up the refugee camp as well as the hospital that treated many of the victims, including those that Mengele had done his experiments on.
Wow. And I understand he was present also for, you know, the liberation of three of the camps in particular.
Right. Buchenwald, Nordhausen, and Mittelbau-Dora.
And throughout this entire time he was there, he was writing these letters home to your grandmother.
Every day, or he tried to write every day. And in the beginning, he did write every day because when he was in England, he was mostly just waiting to cross the channel and begin his work. Because his work and the work of the rest of the civil affairs men was essentially to clean up the mess that the army left behind. to stabilize the health and welfare of the civilian population, to treat those who had suffered from collateral damage. But he also got called into treating the soldiers as he followed behind the army. And so in France, he was mostly treating civilians, but then he was pulled into the Battle of the Bulge, and he was treating the soldiers and also taking care of many of the refugees from that trauma.
So a wide variety of different types of medical ailments.
Exactly. Wow. I mean, he was doing everything from treating battlefield wounds to delivering babies.
And these letters that he wrote home documenting all of this, you know, when we spoke earlier, you mentioned they sat in a laundry basket for many, many years.
A picnic basket.
A picnic basket, I'm sorry. How did you come into possession of this, and did you realize almost immediately the significance of what you had?
Well, these letters set in a picnic basket from the time my grandmother read them, and then she put them back into the original envelopes that are postmarked with the stamps on them, and she just threw them into a picnic basket at that time. And after the war and when he returned home, the picnic basket was just thrown into an attic in Nashville. Now, Nashville is a very hot, humid climate during the summer, and there was no air conditioning at that time. So they sat in this, you know, wicker picnic basket in a very hot, humid environment, and many of the envelopes resealed from the heat and humidity. So when I opened them, it was almost like I was opening them for the first time.
Wow.
And they run the gamut from being extraordinarily romantic to explaining all of the trauma and the fear and the real experience of war, to at times, right when he gets into France and he's never been to France before and he's seeing Paris for the first time, it reads like he's on this grand European adventure during the evenings, and he's doing regular clinical doctor type work during the day. But once the Battle of the Bulge comes and he comes into Belgium and Luxembourg and then into Germany, the letters get progressively darker, and there are also bigger gaps between the letters, and he virtually will say in a letter, "Forgive me that you haven't heard from me for 2 weeks, but I've essentially been working around the clock and there's no time to write."
Yeah. Did you find the letters difficult to read, either physically just because they faded over time or emotionally due to the content?
Both. I had to transcribe some of them and then put him away for a while, and then transcribe some and put him away for a while. He was a physician, so he had a physician's handwriting, and it was sometimes difficult to, you know, determine exactly what he was saying, though over time I got accustomed to his handwriting and it became easier and easier. But some of the subject material was somewhat disturbing. In one letter, he writes about how a woman comes in and she's all upset because her son is missing, and they're teenagers, young boys. And he talks about how 16 young French boys were murdered and then just thrown in the ground with a little bit of dirt covering them. These aren't soldiers. These are just local boys in France. And I'd find myself at night having trouble sleeping after I'd read these kind of stories.
Yeah. We're speaking today with Paula Iacampo. She's the granddaughter of Dr. Price Duff, whose letters home during World War II document his work with the Army's Civil Affairs Division and are the basis for a new exhibit being premiered at the Holocaust Museum and Education Center of Southwest Florida titled "Dearest Pauline, a World War II Healer Writes Home." The museum's executive director, Amy Snyder, joins us as well. Listeners can connect with our guests with a phone call to 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or follow the live Twitter chat using hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Amy Snyder, I know Paula eventually reached out to, you know, our local Holocaust Museum here. Did your staff initially really understand, you know, the significance of what Paula was holding on to before they came out to really see it for themselves?
Well, there's a very long story behind that, which we won't get into today, but it's a humorous story, which Paula can relate to another time. But yes, we were thrilled. We're always thrilled when someone comes to us with personal documentation. And, you know, it took a few phone calls and a visit to really see what this was about. And, you know, that the tagline of our museum is making history personal. we want our visitors to understand that these big events were impacting individual lives, people just like us. And so the opportunity to showcase this story, this life, this segment of a life of Dr. Price Duff is exactly what we do, to bring home, as Paula said earlier, the realities of war on the other side of the world 70 years ago, so that we can begin to understand them today and see how they connect to our own lives.
And Amy, how much time and effort has gone into, you know, converting these letters into, you know, a cohesive story that you can tell in a physical space like a museum exhibition? What's involved in that process?
Huge amounts of time. Cody Rademacher is our curatorial specialist, and he has spent hours upon hours with Paula and her family, really calling out what will be the most appropriate pieces to show, what was the story we wanted to tell, and what are the items that are going to highlight that in the best way for the public to understand. And if you've been to our space, you know that it is very small. So we have a limited amount of space to tell this incredible story. And, you know, hopefully it's starting to be put up today, actually. The pieces are starting to come together, ready for the opening on Sunday. And we hope that in the space and with the selections that we've been able to do justice to the story.
And I know this is the world premiere opening of this exhibition and of this story right here at the Holocaust Museum and Education Center of Southwest Florida. But other museums, I'm sure, have expressed interest. Do we know where it'll be going after that?
Not specifically, but we have interest certainly from Tennessee, where Dr. Price was from. We have some colleagues there that have already inquired about that. And I know that Paula has spoken with some people as well that are interested in bringing this to their own community. So I think there definitely will be very wide interest. And sort of once we've got the opening under our belt, we can sit down and hammer out those details. But it is one of the things that we teach about the Holocaust is that there is the universal part of war and the Holocaust, and then there's the unique part, which sets it in that time and place. And so, again, with this story, we have both, that unique story of a single person with his unit in the midst of the last 2 years of the war, but then the universal themes of that will be attractive to people in the broader outside our community, but certainly around our country.
All right. And Paula, going back to your grandfather's story, I understand that in addition to his official work, you know, based on his skills as a physician, he was called on to do other things as well, and maybe kind of annoyed him a little bit. Can you tell us about that?
Right. Well, when he was in London and they were waiting to cross the channel, unless there was, and it did happen, there were blitz bombs and a lot of destruction, he'd be called in to help with the, you know, medical problems for the collateral damage. But he wasn't able to use his medical skills much when he was in England. So the Army put him to work as the Army censor. And it was a job he hated because he said all the letters sounded the same and he kept reading the same thing over and over and over again from different soldiers. And it disturbed him somewhat because he said they all sounded like beggars. It was, please send this and please send me this. I need this. I need that. And he would look around and see the population of the civilians. They were really hurting. There wasn't enough food. You know, there wasn't enough clothing. Everything was being destroyed. But the officers in the Army, they had everything they needed. Even the enlisted men had everything they needed. They had plenty of clothing. They had plenty of food. And so he got annoyed with the soldiers asking for more. He did talk about, though, when the soldiers asked for gum and for candy, it was never for themselves. Mm. It was for the children. But one of the things I do want to mention is this exhibit is not just letters. He also had a lot of memorabilia. He had Nazi propaganda cards. There's all kinds of things that were actually sent in the letters that verified or enhanced the story he was telling in the letters. So, for example, just to give you one quick example, he writes a letter about how they confiscated some champagne, and they confiscated the champagne from the Germans, who had confiscated it from the French. Mm-hmm. And he says they enjoyed 5 bottles of it with gusto, and it was wonderful. And he soaked the label off of the bottle to put it in the letter to send it home. So that letter and that label, with lots of other types of memorabilia he picked up, will be on display. I think the most interesting, at least interesting for me, item in that exhibit is a microscope that he actually used in Germany. And the microscope, Cody was able to trace back through the serial number the original owners of this microscope. It was manufactured and sold in 1939 to a chemical weapons type plant, an ammonia plant, that used slave labor. So he picks up this microscope and he uses it while he's over there. And then when he leaves to come home, he disassembles the microscope. He takes it completely apart. He ships it home in parts. When he returns to Tennessee, he reconstructs the microscope and he uses it for 40 years in his private practice. And when the private practice was sold, it was the one piece of equipment that he wouldn't let be sold. And we have that on display. It's still in spectacular condition with all the original parts, the original extra lenses, and the original operating instructions in German that he laminated.
Wow. And that was the one thing he wanted to keep from the
practice,
too.
So that's just to give you an example of the kind of things that will be in the exhibit beyond the letters.
Well, and the letters themselves, some of them anyway, would serve as artifacts. They were somewhere written on SS stationery.
He used whatever he could find. And he'll say in some of the letters, I'm writing on an atlas. I'm writing on a box. I'm running out of stationery. He's picking up whatever he can find. And yes, some of the letters are written on SS stationery.
And you had mentioned again when we spoke before the show that, you know, when he got to the camps, the letters in some way kind of read almost like a survival guide for how to get through conditions like that. Can you?
I think I interpret them that way.
Right.
Because, you know, like I said, there was a time when it sounded like this grand adventure, like he's just working in a regular doctor's office during the day and he's experiencing all the joys of Europe and Paris in the evening. But about the time of the Bulge, they start, you know, they get much darker, and you see a shift in his psychology where he's no longer writing like a foreign correspondent. He's dealing with some of the most horrible things a human can possibly deal with, and he's explaining them as best he can in order to still keep in mind the censorship regulations. And then he will just pull out something that will be like, I passed a castle yesterday that looked like Cinderella's. Or spring is in full bloom, and soon the April showers will bring May flowers. But these things are sandwiched in between really awful events.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see where he's using almost his therapy, his writing home to his wife. He's trying to stay in touch with the world at home and his family at home and keeping in mind that that's his goal, is to get back there. And that at a certain point, there's a letter where you can really see everything shifts. I've heard it said that there are two most important days in your life, the day that you're born and the day you realize why you were born. And in those letters, I can pinpoint the exact date of the day he realized why he was born, where he talks about how he's doing so much for human suffering, and he's making up for all the times he felt he was being overpaid. Now, and by that, he's referring to the times he's working as an army censor. But he's a physician living on an army pay. It's at the time $250 a month. It's not enough to support his wife and daughters back home. So they move in with her mother. And yet he feels like he needs to earn his captain's pay by doing what he was hired to do. And then he goes on to describe all this clinical work he's doing. And then finally, as he's signing off on the letter, it says, pray for me that I can see this job through. And he's never said anything like that in the letters before. So you really recognize a shift in his storytelling.
Well, and you know, not everybody he was with had the, for lack of a better phrase, the mental fortitude to do what he was doing.
Exactly. And it's fascinating because at a letter he wrote from Buchenwald. And Cody was able to do enough research to determine that this letter was written there. And how he was able to determine that the letter was written there is he's describing certain events. And at the Shoah Foundation, where they do the oral testimonies, there is one of the men who serves under Dr. Duff, and he's remembering now 50 years later in this oral testimony what was happening in Buchenwald, and he describes in detail, using the exact same vocabulary that Dr. Duff used, to explain how one of their officers, who happened to be the other physician that went into Buchenwald with Dr. Duff, how he mentally cracked up, was on his way back to the States. And Dr. Duff goes on to say, "I don't think I have enough brains left in this feeble head to crack up." That physician then, when he returned to the United States, committed suicide. Well, he was single and he was Jewish. And I think you can see that what enabled Dr. Duff to keep going and to deal with all of these horrible events was he always communicated with home, and he kept that goal in mind of getting home to his wife and daughters. And that's what gave him the emotional, physical, and mental fortitude to just kind of put one step in front of the other and keep doing what needed to be done.
Even still, an experience like that never leaves you. Again, when we had spoken earlier, you had talked about whenever he came back home, there were certain signs that today we would probably identify as post-traumatic stress disorder, like how upset he would get if he ever lost a patient.
Exactly. He clearly was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder for quite some time. And my aunt and my mother and my grandmother used to say that when he lost a patient, they didn't want to come home. They'd go somewhere else rather than come home because he'd be so upset and so despondent and so angry. And clearly now we know that obviously, this was bringing back all the trauma of the patients he lost, particularly in Buchenwald, 300 a day. There were 300 deaths per day when he reached Buchenwald. And one of the things he used to say later in life was his greatest regret in life was that he didn't get there sooner. He used to say 3 days earlier, they could have saved so many more lives. And then later, I was 15 years old, and I was visiting him, staying with him for a couple of days one summer, and he took me to work with him. And I was watching him work, and, you know, one day I called him Granddaddy, "Granddaddy, is there anything that kind of grosses you out or that you just can't do?" And he said, "Yes, I can't work on eyes. If I get a patient that has an eye injury, I send them somewhere else." And I asked him why that was, and he said when he was in Germany and then later in Austria where the hospital was, he said he treated the patients that Mengele had done his experiments on, and a lot of those experiences were done on eyes. And he couldn't work on them without remembering all of that and feeling somewhat traumatized by it. So he basically just said, "I'm not doing my patients any favors by working on them when I'm in that condition."
Were there any other signs that you saw about how his experience in World War II impacted his approach to medicine and his practice when he came back?
Absolutely. In fact, before he went over, he was basically a country doctor. He was in the Cumberland Plateau, which is and was then a very poor and rural area. It's the same town, Crossville, Tennessee, where Sergeant York was from, and in fact, he and Sergeant York made up the draft board, and they remained close friends for life. But he was essentially, you know, a country doctor. When he went overseas, then he was exposed to more patients, sometimes in a day, than a doctor, particularly a country doctor, might see in a month or perhaps even a year. And he was seeing everything from these medical experiments to battlefield injuries. He was delivering babies. He was doing minor surgery. He was setting broken bones. He had this breadth of experience that even though he was a Vanderbilt Medical School graduate, that you're of, you know, just normal small-town doctor wouldn't experience. Then when he got back to Nashville and he set up his private practice, he set up a practice in a very poor part of Nashville, and he didn't take appointments. He opened the doors at 9 o'clock, and the people would just line up. And he worked like a little mini triage unit, and he'd take the most serious patients. And he basically did this for 40 years. Well, then later, my brothers became stockbrokers, both of them. One of my brothers operated in Nashville, and to prospect when he started his career, he got a list of the Vanderbilt Medical School graduates who had gone into practice in Nashville. He started calling around, you know, just blindly prospecting, and he would say, well, I don't think you know me, but I believe you know my grandfather, or you knew my grandfather. And they would say, who was that? And he'd say, Dr. Price Duff. He said there were two answers, and only two answers, that every doctor gave him. Number one was, he sent me my first patient. Number two was, he was the best diagnostician in the state of Tennessee. So he went overseas, just an ordinary country doctor, but he came back Gregory House.
Yes. Amy Snyder, you know, we know these kinds of letters and things exist out there, but how rare is it to come across, you know, really a collection this extensive?
Oh, it's very rare. And, you know, you'll find once in a while people will have a handful of letters or one or two letters. But we know how difficult it is over, you know, 50 years, 60 years, 70 years to, if you move or family members get things get lost, and this far down the road, it's hard to have such an intact collection. But as Paula mentioned, you know, there's the letters, but then there are all of these other things that go with it, and the whole family has really been involved in helping us build what will go into this exhibition. You know, Paula has certainly been the cornerstone and has done an incredible amount of work, but she had to pull some of that in from her family members. You know, they each have letters and they each have pieces of their grandfather's collection of his life. And it's just an incredible opportunity to bring it all together, to tell the story. And it's truly a beautiful story of a man, as Paula said, who has found his purpose in life, who loves his family, and who has left an incredible legacy of learning and of what a reputation to have that experience when your grandson calls around and to know. I don't know if he would have known how people would have remembered him, but what an incredible legacy and what an honor for this family to carry that forward for him.
Well said. And unfortunately, we are up to the bottom of the hour, so we do have to leave things there. But thank you so much, Amy and Paula, for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Amy Snyder is the executive director of the Holocaust Museum and Education Center of Southwest Florida. And Paula Iacampo is the granddaughter of the late Dr. Price Duff, who treated survivors of Nazi concentration camps and World War II, and whose letters sent home during that time serve as the basis for a new exhibit that the museum will premiere on February titled Dearest Pauline, A World Healer Writes Home. A World War II healer writes home, I should say. And that exhibit opens February 1st and runs through May 3rd. There's more information about the exhibition, today's show, and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. This is WGCU Fort Myers 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM.